coming up.
And I went very, very, very psychotic. I went, so it was extremely bad. I deconstructed my entire life. I thought I was the second coming of Jesus Christ. Sure. I moved up to Mpumalanga and I lived in an African rural village for 2 years.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. Six South African male medical doctors on a mission to change the way in which we perceive healthcare. Today, we've got another lovely guest joining us. It's Natalie McCowan, a social worker and mental health advocate, here to share with us some of her insights into life and mental health. Mm-hmm. So without further ado, let's give her a warm round of applause and welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us, Natalie, how'd you get here?
Sure. I got a very interesting message saying, you know, I was asked to do this this interview and talk about my addiction, and I can't make it. Would you please do it for me? And I was like, okay.
Wait, so you're trying to get another addict? and they were like, well, I'm not available now.
Yeah, she is in Cape Town, so she's only arriving in Joburg tomorrow. So it wasn't possible.
And is she still an addict?
No, she's in recovery. Yeah, doing an incredible job.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you for making the time to be here, and it's lovely to have you. Maybe let's start with, we always like to just find out a little bit about your background. So where are you from?
I was born in the UK. We moved to South Africa when I was about six, and I've sort of grown up here, got into all my trouble here, came right here.
Okay.
Mostly wonderful. In Joburg, yeah.
Okay, so grew up here, you're based here, all right. So, obviously, I mean, let's just cut straight to the chase. So, you were an addict of some sort of substance, and you managed to break free of that. Tell us why, how did this happen? A lot of the stories that we've currently heard is, you know, there's some sort of trigger, something that you, through your recovery or through your healing process, have sort of identified as a factor that led you down the path of using substance to sort of self-treat.
That's a beautiful way of putting it. So I've got multiple presentations of my addiction. I mean, like when I'm speaking to my clients, I call them faces, you know, like, you know, so it's the substances, it's the eating disorders, it's the behaviors, romance, goodness, there's a, like, if you can get addicted to it, like, I've done it. I pretty much have.
Yeah.
You know, the only way I can explain it is that I don't remember ever feeling okay. And in fact, if I look back into my childhood, even back to age six, like I was stealing chocolates from my parents. Like at Christmas, I was telling the story to someone yesterday. My parents would give us like six slabs of chocolate on Christmas Day. They would be gone by lunchtime. You know, so like I can't remember a time when I didn't behave addictively or like have a really strange relationship with food, where some people like have a few pieces of chocolate and were fine. Like I just wasn't. Like I just wanted it all and I wanted more afterwards. And then, you know, the first time I had alcohol, like unsupervised, I think I was 16, and I mean, the first time I drank supervised, I got a Reds, and I drank it, and I've got a really nice feeling, and I wanted more, and I couldn't have more, and that was that. And then when I drank unsupervised, there was a bottle of peach schnapps around and a bottle of peppermint liqueur, and I don't remember how much of it I drank. What I remember is projectile vomiting all over the bathroom, you know? That's what I remember, and thought it was great the next day and wanted to do it again. You know, makes no sense, actually.
Wow.
But, like, that's what it was. And it was the same thing when the first time I had substances, I just thought this was a really great idea. And because it felt good. So the only way I can explain it is there was something that wasn't okay. And getting out of myself felt really, really good. And then everything sort of perpetuates itself.
I see.
So we'll call that, like, usually we just call it addictive personalities, and then we just move on past the topic, usually in the medical field.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you mentioned, there's something that if you dive a bit deeper, there's something that maybe in a childhood or something in the beginning that maybe caused the addictive personality, the addictive behaviors. So what do you think, like you mentioned, you want to be outside of your skin, so maybe escapism. Would you say escapism is usually a big reason for addiction, or what do you think?
I mean, I suppose you could say the word escapism, but I mean, I guess, well, I mean, it took me a really, really long time to get to the place of understanding that actually my mental health is just not, you know, doesn't have the same kind of resilience that other people's do. Like, I think genetically or for whatever reason, like, my brain just doesn't have the same capacity that other people's had. So I've had to really learn to take care of myself. So, I mean, if I think, well, what would a child with a brain that doesn't quite manage to do what it needs to do for itself, maybe that's what I was kind of sitting with. And yes, maybe I definitely wanted to escape that, because it's very strange living in a world where you're looking at the people around you thinking they must have some kind of handbook on how to deal with life, because I didn't feel like I had it. Like, people seemed to like be able to do the social interaction thing, and I just had no idea what was going on, and I had all these feelings inside me, and it didn't look like anybody else had these kind of feelings. So yeah, I mean, absolutely, I wanted to get the hell out of that.
I like how you describe it as a handbook, because people, if you do like psychotherapy, they'll like, so some people just are able to do things, like they don't their thoughts won't spiral into some other direction. But if you go through some kind of therapy, it's almost like you learn how to drive, like you learn how to manage yourself in life, to say, okay, these are how I must do things, and this is the structure I should follow. Some people just don't have that. They need to like learn it, and it's a skill that you can learn.
Yeah, so it seems like, I mean, obviously you were struggling with quite a lot, like you mentioned, a lot of different addictions, and it was more of a personality, you think a personality issue, where you struggled, you know, letting go of a lot of things. But I'm just interested in, what would you say was the one thing where you felt, you know, this was very difficult to let go of, and sort of, you know, to your detriment, was sort of caused a lot of the problems in your life. And at what stage in your life did you come across this one drug or substance or whatever it was?
So the way you asked the question, I didn't actually even think about substances. What I thought about was the thing that took me so long to sort of come across, that sort of allowed things to shift for me, was that, first of all, it took me ages to realize that, you know, you can't get into recovery for substances and carry on having an eating disorder and thinking that everything's going to be okay. It's like you've got to actually deal with all the aspects of your addiction. But what I didn't know was that I hadn't grasped the fact that I had issues with mental health. Like, I hadn't gotten that. Like, I was an addict. That's what I was. I was an addict. And when I finally got to the place of, I got other diagnoses, depression, anxiety, borderline personality disorder. And it was really helpful when I started getting those diagnoses and realizing, oh, you know what? Like, I'm not an addict. I am someone with very severe mental health challenges, and it's a much bigger picture. And once I understood there was a much bigger picture, I understood how to treat myself differently. Rather than trying to treat an addiction, I started treating my mental health.
Thanks for highlighting that. And I think for me, you know, what I'm getting, because, you know, whenever we think of substance or we think of addiction, we tend to somehow want to put a drug, you know, that's associated with it. And I think you teach us a different angle to understanding addiction, that addiction can actually be a part of a spectrum, not necessarily. So it can be other underlying mental issues. And addiction is actually part of, you know, the symptoms of, let's say, for example, depression or OCD or whatever the problem is. So how were you able to then, you know, get help? I mean, when did you get to a point where you're like, okay, I have a problem and I need to seek some kind of help? What were the triggers?
Well, I mean, I think, Shem, I mean, I feel so sorry for all the people who love me, because it took me a really long time. Like, I had to learn multiple lessons over and over again. So, I mean, I went to rehab when I was 22 and got clean of the substances, but didn't get clean around my eating disorder. I didn't think, you know, I didn't stay away from toxic relationships. You know, I mean, I carried on thinking I could be clean but live dirty, basically, you know, and managed to do 8 years, started studying my social work degree, I had a really good life. I was running addiction prevention workshops in schools. I was counseling. Things were really beautiful, but I was getting more and more and more unwell, and my behaviors were getting worse and worse. And then eventually I started using again, and I went very, very, very psychotic. It was extremely bad. I deconstructed my entire life. I thought I was the second coming of Jesus Christ. Sure. I moved up to Mpumalanga and I lived in an African rural village for 2 years. And I lost my mind. I mean, you know, when people say they lost their mind, like I really did. It was bad. It took a long time to come back from that.
We have to stop. I mean, you say Percy, I heard a lot of things there. There was second coming of Jesus Christ, African village in Mpumalanga. At that point, did you have any at all, like sort of insight or judgment, or were you just acting on impulse? And then the follow-up question to that is, do you think that addiction comes from like poor impulse control? Because you also do see high-functioning people who, in other aspects of their life, they can avoid doing things impulsively. But for just the substance, they just cannot say no. They find themselves just not being able to say no. What do you think? What do you think the connection with impulse control is?
Sure. So I know impulse control is a big one. I think it's very difficult to see that those kind of behaviors and not see poor impulse control right along with it. I mean, it's essentially that's what's going on for us.
But do you think that there are also a category of people, like, do you get like high functioning? So in every other aspect of their life, they can sort of control themselves. They, you know, can get up every day, go to work. They can maybe even sort of say no to the chocolate, for example, exercise every day, but still there's just something that doesn't allow them to say no to that drug. Have you also seen that in your time, or do you find that there's just a strong correlation between people that, you know, have poor impulse control and?
I've definitely seen high functioning alcoholics where, you know, or high functioning addicts, where you can really, and you can't understand how they can manage to hold all of those things together yet not get this one aspect of their life together. The truth is, I have no insight around it. There are some things I just don't actually understand and can't make sense of. You know, someone was speaking to me before the show and was hoping that I might have some answers for something, and sometimes I actually don't. I really don't. I mean, I look at these things and all I can do is say, there's something to think about, something to talk about, but I wouldn't have an answer.
I was just anecdotally wondering what your experiences was and potentially if you encountered patients or anything that in your time.
But I think if someone's addictive, they tend to be addictive in most things, right? So they'll overeat, they'll have alcohol addiction, whatever it is, they'll tend to have that personality in all things, right?
Like have no control.
If it's specific, maybe there's some other reason why. Like let's say those other things are not socially acceptable, or they just don't have access to it. You know what I mean? That's probably the most simple reason.
What do you think, Kanta?
Like I said, I mean, I'm finding this very informative for me in a sense that, you know, my understanding of addiction is always, you know, this person can control quite a lot in their lives, but there's just this one thing where they struggle with, which I feel our guest has just highlighted that with her, it's not like that, you know. But I mean, Ness, I don't know what you're saying. With most addicts, do you find that they have a problem of addiction in
every facet of their
every
life.
Facet, it tends to be.
So they want and you're saying like anything that gives them a dopamine,
they'll be addicted to it.
Is they going to be addicted
they'll
to it?
They'll be addicted to smoking, alcohol, overeating, whatever it is. It tends to be like that. If they are not, then there's something that is like socially not acceptable. Maybe they're a woman and then smoking is, they don't think it's nice for them, right? But then alcohol, maybe wine, they'll be addicted to it. But if they were to drink alcohol, they would also have that tendency. You know what I mean?
Because the thing is, I've always thought about it as, obviously with stimulants, any kind of stimulant, you're getting this dopamine, increased dopamine use, and that triggers reuse. So, I mean, if something is not a stimulant, you know, where are you getting all this, you know, sort of dopamine release or excitement, if I may put it that way? And continuous one to use of a substance. But yeah, I understand. I mean, if there's an underlying mental health issue, for example, if there's bipolar mood disorder, and every time you're manic, you sort of, you know, you hop into all these different things. Then we're dealing with a completely different sort of diagnosis. It's not someone who's just, you know, an alcohol abuser, you know, sort of an alcohol abuser, but we're talking of someone with bipolar and alcohol abuse. Yeah, so
have you heard the experiment called Rat Park?
Mm-hmm.
So Rat Park was an experiment where they took like pre-addicted rats that are addicted to morphine. Okay, then they put them.
So they were already addicted.
Addicted, right? And they put them like, if you put them in a cage and there's like morphine, they'll just live their life just eating that morphine all the time. They'll die out of hunger, right? Even if there's food there, they'll just focus on that morphine. But then they put them in, then they did another experiment in like 1970, right? They put them in like a park. There's like things to play with. There's like a running wheel and all those other things. And there's also morphine. They would stop being addicted to the morphine and then they'd go play in that rat park.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's like addiction is more than just this drug is giving me pleasure. There's also something else that can make you, you're missing something that is like, it's something that's giving you like a reason or a meaning or something that can take you out of that addiction loophole. Yeah.
Do you agree with that, Matt?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it reminds me of that thing about the opposite of addiction is connection. You know, it's not about necessarily stopping the drugs. It's about finding something to replace it. Because, I mean, I think addiction is a desperate attempt to meet a very violently hungry need inside, you know, some kind of desperate need that's so hungry it's willing to do terrible things to meet that need. And it's like, how do we start finding a way to meet our needs in healthy ways?
Like you must find what you're substituting it for. If you're overeating, what's the need that you're trying to fill with the food? That kind of thing.
And then I don't think you answered my first question.
I hadn't finished telling you. We got distracted in the village.
Yeah. Okay, answer that, then tell us about the village, because we have to know about the village.
You have to tell us about the village.
After the village, when I eventually came back, I started working again, got a job, but immediately started using and drinking again, and
was that just because of the stress pressure? Or?
I mean, I was quite traumatized when I got back from the village. It was an incredible experience, but it was also very traumatizing. So it was like, it's a very interesting thing to talk about. And so I ended up getting drunk at work and got caught. And they went through a process of dismissing me, and I was prepared to get help. They still dismissed me, but I went and I got help anyway. And I got sober for a few years. And during those few years, I also decided I was going to sort out my eating disorder. But I didn't sort out the stuff around the toxic relationships, because I thought I could still do all of that stuff. You know, I thought I could still like be in obsessive relationships and have my emotional roller coaster, my life be emotional roller coaster like this. And, that ended up causing a bit of a mess. And about 6 years ago, like, it was about, these are all the different faces of my addiction, and I can't actually be okay without them. So it was about getting rid of everything. It was about, like, going, okay, I actually really can't do any of these things because it's not okay for me. And then what was very interesting for me is I found out what happens when you, because then we had COVID, and my dad got cancer, and he was really, really ill, and I was really, really struggling. I mean, I had so much shame from what happened in the village and how I've destroyed my life. And I was really like, I mean, I was really, really, really battling. And I got to a place where I actually thought that the world would be better off without me, that people would actually breathe a sigh of relief that I wasn't around anymore, because they would be like, okay, but at least it's over. Okay. So like, no, we don't have to go through this with her anymore. So I tried to kill myself. And I was, what really got me, this was the thing that surprised me, is I didn't anticipate failing. It never occurred to me that I could fail at this. Like, I didn't know it was actually really hard to kill yourself. So when I woke up in the hospital the next day, I was furious because I'd really, really been planning on leaving. But I'd done even more damage. I'd done as much damage as if I'd relapsed and gone out into wherever I would have gone to. I'd hurt the people I loved. But what was really powerful was that I was like, I don't need drugs to circle the drain. Like, I did not need any of my unhelpful behaviors to get me to a place where I'm done. And then I was like, because it's not normal to want to kill yourself. It's not a, that is really not a normal place to be. So I'm luckily, I was so lucky to get to, admitted to Tara. I went to ward 4 and 5 there, which, I got beautiful treatment there. Food's not so great, but the therapy, the nurses, that it was really good. I got introduced to DBT therapy and, and that was the first like inkling for me that my problem was bigger than addiction, that it was about mental health and that I needed to actually learn the skills and learn how to live in a way that where I'm okay, you know. And I think the best way to explain that is that, you know, sometimes I get these ideas that I'm capable of this much, but actually I'm only capable of this much. And whenever I try to do this much, end up falling apart because I can't cope. But if I will learn to work within this much, like, first of all, that gradually gets bigger. But I'm an incredibly happy, useful, wonderful human. So it took a really long time and lots of like, detours. A lot of detours.
Yeah. Like, and on that, let's talk about that detour. A very big detour in your life. So,
but before we talk about the detour, right, I think you just touched on something very important as part of your recovery, especially at Tara. Just for someone, you know, at home who's wondering, you know, let's say I have something similar to what you have, or I think I have a serious issue. What kind of treatment were you getting? Like, what's DBT, for example? What do you think helped you about being there? I mean, besides the nurses being nice and, you know, the doctors and the other allied workers, what would you say for you in the therapy was life-changing?
So DBT is dialectical behavioral therapy, and it's composed of mindfulness, learning emotion regulation, learning distress tolerance, and learning interpersonal effectiveness. So there are skills for each of those sections. And for me, mindfulness was like learning a superpower. Like, everything is possible if you're mindful. Like, if you're disconnected from your reality, how are you supposed to know you're not okay right now and you need to maybe take a step back or go take a nap or, you know, have a time out from that person? You know, so mindfulness for me was huge. And it's such a powerful thing for me to teach my clients as well, because I'm like, every other skill and tool is at your disposal if you're mindful.
Give us a quick crash course in.
On mindfulness. Okay, so John Kabat-Zinn, he's the grandfather of mindfulness. He is the rock star. He talks about mindfulness as being paying attention to the present moment on purpose, non-judgmentally, as if your life depends upon it, because it does. That's his description. And he's very funny. I mean, I don't even have to use my own words because he's so funny. He'll say things like, you know, next time you're in the shower, you know, maybe try and see if you actually really are in the shower. And that we're very lucky that we don't have to be mindful about breathing, because otherwise you'd be like, oh, look, a squirrel, and then you're dead. You know, like mindfulness is like this incredible power to actually attend. Like, our brains are always, we're thinking. We're very good at thinking. We're thinking people. We think. We don't necessarily attend to things. So that's John Kabat-Zinn on mindfulness.
So it's like being in the present.
Yes.
Because like people have depression or be thinking about the past a lot, and then their thoughts go to the past, then they get depression because of that. People who have anxiety will be thinking about the future, and they're always anxious about the future. But if you just try to be more present, all those problems go away.
Yeah. And I think, the other thing about DBT was it's bizarre, you know, the emotion regulation stuff. So for me, when they started teaching emotional regulation, like the takeaway for me was that emotions could be regulated. I didn't actually even know emotions could be regulated. I was like, you mean I can regulate this thing? I was like, bonus. Like, even when I was falling apart, all I had to do was tell myself, I'm like, this can be regulated, actually. This is not going to tear you apart. So, I mean, for me, like, I don't even know if I took any skills away from it besides that. It was just really about going like, oh, I can actually manage this world that has sometimes felt really, really challenging to manage.
And did they at any stage put you on any type of medication? Was there ever a need?
So I was already on some medication. I was on a mood stabilizer and an antidepressant. And I think for a time that was quite valuable. But over the year, I mean, I'm still weaning off my medication, but I'm on a very, very low doses now. And I just made a decision to wean off really slowly, like to take a couple of years and like, let's just not make a spectacle out of anything. I think it was a big thing that happened for me a couple of years ago, and I didn't think I was going to be sharing about this on a podcast, was, I got introduced to psychedelic assisted therapies. And that was a bit of a game changer for me as well. You know, yeah.
I've heard a bit about psilocybin.
Yeah, psilocybin.
Ketamine,
yeah.
I think MDMA.
MDMA.
Also.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Professor Musa also has. Online sort of clinic.
That does ketamine. Yeah.
Yes.
Ketamine therapy. So tell me about that. How did you get introduced to that therapy, and what has it done for you specifically?
So what was happening for me is that I was literally, because it's taken me, this is 2023, and it took me, that was my final year for my social work degree, and I was starting my fourth year, and I knew I was doing my practicals. I got my practicals at Sanders Manor, where I'm now the program manager, and I was like, okay, so there's going to be lots going on this year. So I'm going to register on the first day of the year, and I'm going to get everything organized so I can do all that like theory work first, so that it won't be so pressurizing during my practicals. And we got to March, and I'd done absolutely nothing because I was really, really depressed, and I was really struggling. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I mean, I was on the medication, and I got really, really desperate. And I'd obviously been very wary about something like psilocybin, given my history. I mean, I've even gone psychotic, so I was always really wary. But I also knew that I was in a very, very, really bad space. Mm. So I had went on a psilocybin journey, and besides the journey, the actual visual experiences being absolutely incredible, like the profound moment was like, I woke up the next day, I got up, I cleaned my room, I went and I sat at my desk and I started studying. It was like flipping a switch, and it was in that moment I was like, oh, so that's what treatment-resistant depression feels like. Because I was like, I mean, oh, so maybe the medication wasn't actually doing that much for me, because for some reason it wasn't hitting my depression. And to wake up and just have that feeling just move, have gone, and just be able to pick up my studies and move, I was like, and I think, you know, and my colleagues, we're all very similar. We think that psychedelic assisted therapies are the way of the future, but they are not magic bullets. They are not the solutions to the problem. What they need to be is, you do everything you can and get as far as you can, and when you hit that wall, you'll find that most likely psychedelic assisted therapies can help you climb over that wall.
And was this assisted with a medical professional or someone?
So no, it wasn't a medical professional. I've always preferred doing it with shamans and like people that come from the slightly more spiritual side of things.
Traditional medicine.
Yes, yeah. I kind of prefer that vibe, but you can go either way. It was incredible, and it also reconciled a lot with my past as well. It was like I was sort of like, I looked at all the things that had happened, and I was like, that all is what it is, you know, like it's, and it, you know, the stuff that happened is the price that I pay for the life that I live today.
I think we're also behind in the treatment of depression. Like there's like new meta-analysis coming where they're saying in Nature, where they said like SSRIs are not as effective as we used to think they are, right? They're saying that the whole serotonin, low serotonin theory, they're now starting to think that might not be actually true, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now, like, psilocybin is starting to become an actual proper protocol where they're going to be like micro dosing psilocybin,
yes,
not like full on experiences. And that could be the future, yeah.
Yeah.
And if you don't mind, obviously, discussing.
Not at all.
What sort of drugs would you say, or substances, were you addicted to?
So, pretty much everything except crystal meth, heroin, and crack. Like, I tried all of them, like, maybe once, but I was just like, I don't know, something was just like, just didn't, I don't know why they didn't gel with me, but cat, coke, marijuana, alcohol, sleeping tablets.
Because generally people say that they either prefer the uppers or the downers.
I liked uppers, but, you know, you do have to come down eventually. And, you know, I like to control when I went to sleep.
Oh, okay. And so also you would use the sleeping tablets to help sleep.
And, I would find that the stimulants could sometimes overstimulate me, and then I'd want to. I quite liked combining things. It was kind of fun to, like, control how I was feeling. The alcohol would definitely kind of temper the anxiety that the stimulants would sometimes bring on. But I definitely preferred to be on, like, moving rather than sleeping.
And I think I did also ask this one about, like, which particular drug would you say was probably the most difficult for you to leave or let go of? Or were they all kind of...
I think the thing is that it was... I never tried stopping caffeine. Jeez, definitely caffeine. I still haven't let go of that one. But for me, it's always come to a point of when it's giving up, it's like it's all of them. Because the problem is not one particular substance. Yeah. It was always all of them. So I've never really had to sit and go... It's always like they all have to go.
I think we can go back now to the
village.
I think we're done now with everything else. Now we really need to know what happened in that village in Mpumalanga.
How did you even get there?
Yeah, how did you get
by
there?
By car. it's beyond bonkers because I thought I was getting a calling. When I went psychotic, I thought I was getting a calling.
And was this after, like, were you using a lot of substances?
No, I wasn't using, you know, like, it wasn't actually, I hadn't actually even been using that much at that point. But what had happened was I'd been on medication. And, you know, like, antidepressants, mood stabilizers, etc. And then I started drinking, and then I started smoking a bit of marijuana, and then I started doing a few lines of cats, and then I thought, you know, it's a really bad idea to be taking all this medication and using drugs at the same time. So I'm just going to stop the medication. And then I just came off the medication cold turkey.
So you were like, okay.
So I just stopped that, and my brain just, something funny happened. And the next thing I was hearing voices, and I was the second coming of Jesus Christ. And I was very lucky. I had a very beautiful psychosis. I didn't see horrible demons or think my parents were coming to kill me. I thought I was about to save the world. I was very excited.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you got in your car and you drove.
Because I was going, yes, I was told because I would know where I was going when I got there, and that was the place where I was going to save the world. And I went up to the Kruger National Park to stay with a friend, and it was so bad. He left me in the Kruger Park. And I had made friends with all the people that were working in the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a couple of nights, people slipped me keys for me to stay there. And I was visiting with the people in the village and having a really nice time. I walked into the bush and had an experience meeting an elephant, very not with supervision. It was, a very interesting experience. And then eventually had to go to the reception and go, because you need a pass to get out. Mm. I had no pass. It had expired days ago. So I then had to walk into the reception and tell the manager of Pretoria's Cop Camp that I'd been squatting there for a couple of days. And she's like, this has never happened before. But I told her that I had a calling, and it turned out she'd had a calling as well. What was really interesting is that when she had her calling, she went to a Bible college in Magaliesburg. And the same weekend of the Rugby World Cup in 1995, where she was at the Bible College, I was across the road at the opposite camp getting my first kiss. That's what she discovered.
Oh, wow. Lovely. Yeah. At Bible camp. That's lovely. That's lovely.
So she didn't throw me in jail. We had a really nice moment. They let me stay over and they let me leave. And as I started driving through the villages on the way home, like, I started to get this really heavy feeling in my heart and really struggling to move past this. And I got to a certain village and I was just like, I can't. I can't actually leave this place. And I pulled into a Bible college just around the corner. I told them I had a calling, and they didn't know I was nuts. They thought I really had a calling. Mm. And they let me stay there, and I started visiting the village. And
so, like, where exactly in the village are you living?
In a few places. But, like, with the people in the village, people looked after me. There was this crazy white girl in their village. I mean, they taught me how to cook. They taught me how to hand wash my clothes. It was one of the.
And this whole time you were like, I'm the second coming of Jesus.
Pretty much.
Were you preaching?
Not quite preaching. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was drinking a lot as well. But I mean, no. I mean, I know I did. I mean, I really believed what I was saying. And I think they just thought I was just really nice, nutso person. And I think, I mean, for me, it was such a privilege to get an opportunity to really engage with completely undiluted African culture. And, you know, really, and they were
good. Did you learn any of the language?
Oh, I wish I could say I did, but I only learned a few Swati words. I'm really not good with languages. I wish I'd come out of there with a whole language. It would have been great.
It would be nice.
Yeah. But I did learn how to cook, and I did learn how to hand wash my clothes or wash my clothes in the river. Yeah. And
Like, how would you pass your time? Were you just cooking and?
I mean, I did a lot of drinking, and a lot. I mean, I made friends, and I used to go visit people, and.
But now, if you were in the village, like, and living with people and stuff, did they not, like, integrate you sort of in the community? And you're like, you're a lady, so you're gonna be cooking, and the men are gonna go.
They tried. You know, I was really nuts. I was like, no, I want to go to the tavern with the guys. Like, they're like, no, but the girls sit over there. And I'm surprised they put up with me. I mean, I was really nuts.
Sure.
Yeah. And how long were you in this village?
I was there for 2 full years.
Yeah. So you were drinking at the tavern.
Any kids that you got in your time in that village?
No kids. I did get raped, unfortunately, while I was there in my second year. But it was one of the most profound experiences. Like, it was really beautiful. I don't regret the experience at all, but I'm really sorry that I was completely incapable of taking care of myself, that I put myself into so many dangerous situations so that things like that could happen to me. Like, I really regret that's what I was doing. But I was very blessed to meet people. People wanted to take me into their house. I think wanted me to stay with them. That was like, it was beautiful.
And so you didn't need money. You were just living off the land, so to speak.
Pretty much. I need to go back to that village and make some amends, you know, because people really took care of me. Because, for the most part, I wasn't working. People really took
just
care
kind
of
me. Took you into their home.
Took,
just
gave me hand-me-down clothes. Like, it was just, I was just really.
Yeah, that's what we call
honestly, people in, yeah. And it, like, in, like, you wouldn't find people like you. I don't know why people that would do that. I don't know anywhere else that would have done that to me. They would just be beautiful.
So, I mean, the manic episode is obviously a side effect of the drugs. Kat and the alcohol and all of these things.
Mm.
So we get a lot of side effects from substance abuse. And the one we normally see is schizophrenia from weed.
Mm.
It's so common.
Yeah.
We see it like
the biggest one.
Yeah. Every day.
Yeah, it's tragic.
And now, I mean, you look at, like, in society, how common cannabis stores are. I think the thing is, for the longest of times, alcohol hasn't been seen as a drug. And so now we're just breaking another barrier and saying, well, there's another thing that's out there that's also not really a drug. It's just something that we use recreationally for fun, cannabis. And I think society has to recognize all of these things are substances.
Mm.
Look, you may be addicted to caffeine, but it's not going to ruin your life.
No.
Potentially ruin your life or make you become psychotic or make you make decisions that will put you in vulnerable positions. Like, people think that alcohol is like completely safe.
Mm.
Nothing can go wrong. Mm. Have a couple of drinks. Hey, maybe you'll call yourself an Uber home. The depressant effect that it has is not really spoken about.
Mm.
the effects it has hormonally on your body, the increase in cortisol levels, all of those types of things are kind of negated by the fact that it's just a legal thing that we all kind of socially do.
Yeah.
And now I think as society progresses, we may start seeing more and more substances being listed as okay.
Yeah.
And I think it's, even in your case, the use of psychedelics were very controlled and in a proper environment in order to gain a specific therapeutic effect.
Yeah.
Versus many other substances, even in the same context, which are used for recreational high or just take me out of my senses.
Mm.
And I think it's important to distinguish the two.
Yeah, I think it is important to distinguish the two. And I mean, I mean, and you just, when you were talking about alcohol, I mean, I was also thinking about just, you know, like the violence that happens on the roads as a result. You know, I mean, I've got friends who've been sober for years who killed people, you know, drunk and driving. And the truth is the majority of the drunk and driving accidents on the road are not even done by alcoholics. They're just done by people abusing alcohol. You know, I mean, it's a... I think it's the abuse of substances that becomes the problem.
Exactly. And another thing, well, just going back to what Suhail was saying, is that I think it's just one of those things where you don't make it legal, then it's unregulated, and people are just using, you know, willy-nilly, just getting from someone.
Or creating stuff.
And there's no regulation to dosing. There's no regulation to what people are taking. And I think the episode, the reason why we see so much schizophrenia related to cannabis is because we don't know what people are actually smoking, you know?
Yeah, and, or how much, what percentage much, of
exactly, THC. Yeah.
I think now, hopefully, as legislature improves, they'll be able to monitor that like they do in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
In Amsterdam, people think that, oh, you're going to go there and it's this crazy experience. But on average, they have far lesser THC in their cannabis, in their products in Amsterdam than we do here in South Africa, because it's legislated.
Yeah.
You can't sell something that's of a higher THC value. And the higher the THC dose, the more likely you are to experience these effects of you know, psychosis and schizophrenia, all of these types of...
Because we are seeing, like, where's the line between use and abuse, right? If you take some small CBD gummy before you want to sleep, at night, there's some benefit in there. But then, like, there's this guy smoking weed every single day, multiple times. Then obviously that's abuse. And, like, there's also a lot of... The thing is, we don't know if people actually know what they're doing to their bodies, right? If you knew that you could literally get brain damage from smoking weed, would you actually do it? If you knew that, like, how prevalent GBV is with alcohol, would you be doing it? You know what I mean? Sometimes someone might be like, I don't mind getting gynecomastia, getting a beer belly, getting all these different things from alcohol. But if they knew they could get epilepsy from alcohol, or maybe like brain damage, maybe that's the line they would not cross. Maybe just education. Maybe you have to like write an exam before they drink alcohol.
I also do think to some extent humans, if you make a decision to use something that just gives you a quick dopamine rush, you're not really considering the long-term effects. You're thinking, what is this going to do for me now? How am I going to feel right now? Not how am I going to feel in a month, 2 months, 6 years, when I've been using it consistently and this is the effect that it has on my life, on my body, on my health. I don't think people generally think that far. What do you think in your experience?
Not just
in your own personal experience, but
I mean, it sounds like an epidemic. and I think that, like, I agree. I think that, like, when we're in that space, that all we're thinking about is the right now. It's about instant gratification. We're not able to really think in the long term. And the truth is, you know, to some degree, we do know that those things can happen to us. We've been told. It's not like we haven't been educated. We just don't seem to
care.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't hit. Like, we don't think it's going to happen to us. Like, it's like I'm the exception to the rule. Like that. I mean, I know that. That's what I thought. I was the exception to the rule, and I just wasn't. And I see it with I suppose one of the things I do think we're living in a world, in an age now where we, unfortunately, our youth are getting exposed to these substances earlier and earlier, and that's a major concern for me, because I think we're actually hardwiring brains to seek dopamine and to not be, and to be impulsive. I think we're hardwiring impulsivity, you know, whereas like, I think it's going to be,
I think if you just look at social media, you can sit and scroll and scroll and scroll. People don't realize that that's just, it's giving you quick hits of dopamine.
Mm.
Your brain can suddenly experience one thing and then suddenly experience something else.
Mm.
Then on top of that, there's an algorithm that shows you exactly what you want to see and what you enjoy and you like. Some of it may be helpful, useful information or content, but there could be a lot that's just there to stimulate your brain.
Mm.
I can even say in my own experience, because I work night shifts and things like that, I know to keep myself awake sometimes, I'll just scroll. I found it like, instead of using caffeine or something else, I could just sit and I could scroll for a bit, and now I'm suddenly wired again. I've suddenly got some, you know, catecholamine release into my system, and now I'm feeling this energy. And that's when I realized, oh, this isn't healthy. Yeah. This is a form of a stimulant.
Yeah.
And it can potentially, with what everything else in society currently, we're at the point in society that we've never ever been in before. Anything you want, you could, if you have enough money, you can get at your fingertips, at your disposal anytime. Food, you can get it right now. You can get clothing. You can get drugs.
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 We're talking about drugs. And like just like you were saying that, you know, a more younger generation is having excess. It's like that video I shared with you guys yesterday of how 18-year-olds are doing the craziest of things. And you think to yourself, when I was 18, I had no idea about these things. But we stay in such a small, globalized world with these phones that I think algorithm, you know, the more you spend time watching something, they just pump you with more. So you can imagine a child who enjoys his alcohol or enjoys a certain, you know, whatever, and sees one video on his reels or what's it called? Reels, yeah?
Mm.
And, you know, algorithm just says there's a huge interest here.
Mm.
And they'll pump you with more and more and more and more. And I think, it doesn't only feed the addiction, but also can even potentially add more addiction to that. Because then you start learning, no, people actually can maximize sort of the dopamine release. You know, if I were to use this video that I shared with you guys on somehow some people even buying certain drugs now dyes and dyes that you use in our clinics to like just for corneal staining and things like that, where someone has found that no, if you put this and this, it actually lasts longer. How are you gonna? And these are scientists, by the way. These are just addicts and older people who have access to things. I mean, and you'll find an 18-year-old sitting somewhere and seeing that kind of stuff. So it's really, really scary. Like, where does it end? Where are we going? I just thought, you know, that it's important that we highlight how scary some of these things are, and especially for people with kids. We all say, you know, this is bad and this can cause addiction, but you know, for some people you need to actually highlight what exactly do you mean. I mean, for example, if your child is addicted to, example, porn, they could be easily being supplied with all this information according to algorithm, just to keep them going and keep them, even if it's not visually the porn, but if naked women is what they enjoy watching, which feeds to them obviously watching the porn afterwards, algorithm is just continuously feeding this addiction.
I work with a few sex addicts, and most of them were exposed to porn from a young age. And even if they didn't like it when they first saw it, they still got a very intense feeling. And then the porn continued, and the sex. I mean, that was basically the gateway drug. And to see what it did to them, I mean, they're like, it's incredible. I mean, I've got a client who actually ended up. There's that book, Your Brain on Porn. And like when he actually, I mean, it's amazing because I mean, often I tell people to read books and they don't read books. He actually read the book, or listened to the book. He listened to the book and he was just like, when he heard what was going on inside his brain, like he was just horrified. And when he stopped the porn, he went into like, I could tell you like a withdrawal, like heroin withdrawal. It was, when I saw him 5 days after he'd stopped using porn, he was white and haggard. And I was like, sure, that's serious. Like, it's serious business, that stuff. It's serious.
Because it's, I mean, again, it feeds into the dopamine pathways in the brain.
Mm.
And if those are constantly reinforced by something, whether it's a drug, whether it's this, like, stimulus, such as porn, which is a visual stimulus that gives you this massive dopamine rush to your brain, and you couple that with the physical enjoyment of, you know, masturbation or whatever, those associations can have long-lasting damaging effects, not just to yourself personally, but also in your relationships. And so a lot of young men we see with erectile dysfunction because they just cannot get erect without watching porn.
100%.
And I want to ask, like, how much you think is, because I know this scenario he's talking about is like being triggered. So like Instagram is notorious for like showing explicit stuff as a trigger to people. How much do you think is environment for someone who has an addiction problem? So let's say their friends or the thing that they're exposed to.
So I mean, I really like the concept of the risk factors. You know, that it's like it's our genetics, it's our trauma, it's what we were surrounded by, it's how we did at school, it's you know, that it's all of those things. And they tend to build on one another, and the more that are there, I think it's very hard to say it's just one thing. I mean, I can't say that, for me there was much trauma, or for me there was even that many people around me that were that bad for me. I looked for, you know, I went to find people who would enable my behavior more than the other way around.
In closing, because we need to wrap up, tell us, I think, what's the most profound lessons you've learned on your journey, and what can you share with someone who might be suffering currently with addiction of any kind?
Sure. I mean, I think the most profound thing for me was about realizing how big the job was, that I wasn't just working with addiction, that I was working with something much bigger, that if I took my addiction out the way, all the reasons I were using were still there. And then learning what that looked like and finding, I mean, I think that was the biggest thing for me. I mean, I can't actually think of anything bigger than that, was that actually really understanding what the nature of the problem was. And for people that are suffering, it's just, it's like you need to be able to ask for help. Like it's like one of, like with many things, we just cannot do it alone. You know, we need to get help and we need to get, we need to get help.
And for someone who's fell off the wagon, who's relapsed, who's gone in and out, what words of hope would you have for them?
Sure.
Because I obviously now we've heard your story, we understand that it's not just, hey, I'm addicted, now I'm not, the game's over, and now I can go back to regular program.
So, I mean, I say this to my clients, it's not the most hopeful sounding thing, but the truth is, because I mean, the reality is that this addiction does kill. So the truth is, like, if you don't die, there's a chance for you. That's the truth. Like, if this doesn't kill you, if you come back from it, I've never seen someone who wants to get well not get well unless they've been, like, we're talking rapid onset early dementia happening, and then they've got no capacity to get better. But otherwise, like, if those things, those barriers are not there, people can change. People can get well.
Mm. And it just takes every single day getting up and trying again.
Mm.
And seeking help.
Yeah.
And seeking and the help.
Getting help.
Yeah.
Getting the professional help that you
need. Yeah. And I mean, I was listening to a previous podcast of yours and someone was going on about love and You know, I mean, like, I'm so grateful for the people who love me no matter what, because a lot of people turned their backs on me. A lot of people wanted nothing to do with me, and I understand why, but there were a few people who just didn't give up on me no matter what, and they loved me through all of that. And, like, I mean, like, I'm so grateful to those people for doing that.
Are these the same people who found you in Mpumalanga?
They tried to come and get me out. I mean, and people tried to come and get me, and I was just like, no, this is where I need to be. Like, God said.
Well, we're glad that they found you, Natalie, yeah. And glad that they brought you back so that you could be here on our podcast and share this lovely story with us. So thank you for being here today, and I hope your story touches the lives of hopefully millions. We don't have those views yet, but who knows? Yeah. Maybe millions in the future. Thank you again for sharing with us your difficulties, and hope that one day things can be better, and we can all strive for a brighter future.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. And that's it from me, Dr. Soil Essa, signing out on another episode of Let's Talk Man.
Dr. Vilagazi.
Dr. Naseem Sharif.
Natalie McCowan.
We'll catch you guys next week.